Good afternoon. So far in our course, we went from starting about talking building programs, then talking more about things that the OS does in cooperation with the hardware. We talked about a bunch of things that the hardware provides for OSs to make it possible to run multiple programs alongside each other and have them play nice. We have this idea of kernel mode, exceptions to run the OS, context switches, and virtual memory. We also talked about, well, when the OS has these tools, it has some decisions to make about what programs are allowed to do, and we talked about this mechanism of accounts and permissions for enforcing it. And then we took a divergence to our sort of current topic, which is about communication, that we know we have multiple machines that talk to each other a lot in our modern world, and we talked about, well, what does that look like? And we were mostly focusing on what services, the things that make up the network provide, things being hardware and software together. We had this idea of layers that provide the different pieces of functionality we need to build something like a web browser. You know, we don't build a web browser directly on top of Wi-Fi. Instead, we kind of have this Wi-Fi that provides an interface for communicating with things in the same local network, on top of which we build a way to communicate with things that are not on the same local network, on top of which we build a way of sending big streams of data, even though that's not supported underneath. And on top of that, we build something like a way of retrieving web pages and not just a stream of data with no meaning. And then we moved on to our current topic, which was saying, well, we have this networking, but often we don't really trust it. What can we do about that? And that was sort of our topic last time, is, you know, given that we have a network we kind of don't trust, don't want to trust, how can we actually still communicate on it in a way which, you know, is trustworthy, hopefully? And to do that, we introduced this idea of sort of our big goals, which were confidentiality and authenticity. Confidentiality meaning that when we got messages from someone, that no one else who wasn't intended to read the message would be able to actually, you know, figure out what was in the message. And authenticity meaning that when we got a message apparently from someone, we would be able to tell if they didn't really send the message to us, if that is from someone else, or we found out later, even if it was from them, but it was repurposed for something that wasn't intended originally. And to make this work, we had this sort of fundamental building block that we need some secret information, because otherwise, sort of our attacker, someone who controls our network, can do everything that we can. Because they can send all the same messages we can send, so there's no way anyone else can tell us apart from the attacker. So our solution for that is we're going to have some secret information that only we know, or only the person we're communicating with knows. And we're going to somehow build, using some mathematical tools out of that, ways of communicating securely under the assumption that we actually keep that information secret and somehow set up this communication in a secure way, which is a tricky assumption. And we had sort of two families of methods for this. So a sort of simpler to implement set was based on having shared secrets, that if I wanted to communicate with someone, we would have some shared secret information that we had somehow shared in advance. And from this, we had a tool to give us confidentiality called symmetric encryption, where we encrypt something with this shared secret we call a key, and the other end could decrypt it with the same key. And we had something called a message authentication codes, where you could take something like a checksum with the key, but someone without the key couldn't produce checksums that we would count as correct. And that was kind of our building blocks to actually produce sort of these confidentiality and authenticity with these symmetric schemes. Now, practically speaking, these symmetric schemes have this big problem that to communicate securely, first you must communicate securely. And, you know, that might seem like kind of like not a great deal. So we have some more flexible schemes which are based on this idea of public-private key pairs, that yes, we're still going to have secret information, But we're going to keep our secret information to ourselves, and we're not going to have to communicate anything secret to the person we're communicating with to set things up. Instead, we'll send a public key that's going to be derived from our secret information, which we call a private key. And that public key is going to let someone communicating with us either send stuff to us encrypted so only we can read it, or verify things that we indicate came from us using what we call a digital signature. And because we don't need to keep this public key secret, we can give it to everyone, and it's not going to matter. They aren't going to be able to decrypt messages intended for us with it. They aren't going to be able to sign messages as if they came from us with it. They need a private key for that, which we're never going to share. And then we talked about sort of using these in practice, and we learned that this idea of like having message authentication codes or digital signatures, it seemed like that would give us our authenticity property, that when we got a message, it was from the right person, and all made sense. And we found out in practice that like often didn't work out, that we'd have like two examples where it didn't. So one was replay attacks, that an attacker can repeat messages which aren't intended to be repeated, and generally can use messages in context where they weren't intended, and we need to prevent against that when we're sending messages using these sort of primitives of encryption and authentication signatures and so on. And we also need to worry about sort of machine in the middle, sort of manipulating the messages in other ways to mess up our idea about what the context is. So after talking about those attacks, we started talking about a topic I'll start with today, which is sort of cleaning up that need for initial communication. So we have this great tool of public keys, but even that seems unwieldy. If I want my web browser to just work talking to any website, there's a lot of websites I could talk to. I still need some extra infrastructure for that web browser to get the public keys for that website in a trustworthy manner. We're going to talk about what that is, and we had the basic idea, which was certificates, which we'll review in a bit. So questions about things we covered earlier? Okay, so I think I'll skip to talk briefly about quiz question one, because there was a lot of people had problems with it. So quiz question one was asking about UDP sockets. And a big thing about UDP sockets is the way UDP works is you get kind of the raw sending messages with best effort interface. You don't get a stream of data. So in this case, we wrote first, second, third, and these have to be sent as separate messages. So one thing which can happen is that these messages can be messed up by the network, they can be lost, they can be reordered. The question said they weren't corrupted, but that's in the real world would also be a possibility. So we could have them read in different orders, or none of them came out. Another point of confusion might be, the question said the writes don't fail. And you might say, oh, so that means the message gets there. Well, that's not what the write not failing set means. The write not failing means, I successfully sent the network on the local network. It doesn't mean it got there. It just means it went out the machine. It doesn't tell you anything about how much further it got. So questions on quiz question one? Yes. Okay, so the question is, I was not consistent in using could versus will in the question. That was not intended to be part of the question. It was just sloppy editing, probably. I thought I phrased the question, which of these are possible, to as main thing, which is why I didn't check that very carefully, but I'll have to talk to my TAs to see what they think about it before I decide how that's graded. So get a second neutral opinion about whether how much sense the question makes. Yes? Could I have the UDP socket timeout if I just don't read anything? So something that wasn't mentioned when you talked about sockets in CSO1 is that there are options you can set on the socket which will make read not wait forever. They are not the default, but there are options you can set which will make it actually not wait indefinitely. In which case, if you set those, yes, it would time out. Otherwise, it probably wouldn't. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Was question two, if you made the assumption that the ISPs all had the IP address to start, and so you said 10 rather than 20, is that okay?
So for question three, yeah. The question is, we were assuming, over these 5 hours, you have to make two queries because we had one timeout. So you're asking, what if we assume they had it at the beginning, and we said 10? If you said that explicitly in your comments, that's fine. Probably, unless you noted that you needed to know that information, I'm not sure we'll give you full credit, but if you noted you needed to know that, that's fine. Yes? So the question is, we had this question where A and B were communicating using public keys-based encryption. And we said they securely exchanged information to set this up. And we asked, what should they have after that? And one of the options was they would have a shared secret. And I would say, having a shared secret is very useful, but it's not part of doing public key stuff. Right, it's not part of setting up public key stuff, because you use the public key to show that later. So it's something they could do, but I would say if they're doing that, they're not setting up to use public keys, they're setting up to use symmetric encryption. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do, talk a little about anonymous feedback. So some people say, someone saying, basically, shouldn't I release solutions for the earlier parts of assignment before going on? So I guess there's a couple reasons this isn't happening. So one is that, as you saw from the grading breakdown I published after this, because I realized people probably misunderstood how part three would be graded, a lot of the grade for part three is just getting the assignment done in the first place. Things I intended you to have done in the first couple weeks, but you still get credit if you do them late. So that's one thing. The other thing is that what you're supposed to complete for the first two parts is not like a fixed line for the first part, so there's not really an obvious thing to release. Also, releasing something and not still having a late policy is really awkward. Also, my experience, I'm not sure, has been that a lot of students are spending more of their time getting the levels equals one stuff working than the rest because of where the misunderstandings are. So, like, that doesn't, so not having levels equals one done doesn't necessarily mean that as far as your understanding, you're less than 50% done. That probably varies depending on what parts causing problems. One question, if I could review things at the end of lecture. So the main logistical problem for me to do this is that I usually don't know exactly how much I'm going to cover in lecture. I've been surprised in both directions. So I can't really prepare this, but I probably should do a topic review after I finish a topic, which I have for the topic you did. So I'm saying, hey, I like anonymous feedback, but couldn't we try to get more samples, maybe some upvote, downvote thing? I find that any sort of feedback tool has incredible selection bias. I would like to think of better ways of doing it. Maybe there probably are. I'm not sure I'm going to invest infrastructure this semester on it. And then weekly quizzes. So weekly quizzes are too confusing. I have to rewatch the lectures to answer the questions. That's kind of intentional. So that's not a bug. Some review I expect to be needed a lot of the time. Like, not always, of course, but that's kind of intentional. I do hope questions don't feel vague. I try to get the questions clear. I try to run them by TAs to make them clear. Usually when the questions are unclear, it's because there was editing that happened that didn't have the full number of passes of people looking at the question. But sometimes there are second or third interpretations of the question. My hope is the comments fields mitigates this, and that people's reaction to this could mean two things, is to write a comment saying, I don't know what you mean. I'm guessing you mean this. And that would hopefully mitigate that, but maybe that doesn't do enough. And also someone saying, hey, we have some good TAs. Okay. Questions, comments, anonymous feedback? Before we go on to talking about certificates. Okay, so last time we introduced this idea of certificates, which is, let's say A has B's public key already, and A wants to share it with C. A can send a message to C with the certificate, with a, what we call a certificate, which is a signed message that says, this is what B's public key is. And if C already knows A's public key and trusts A, this is a great way for C to learn B's public key. If C doesn't have A's public key, well, it doesn't really help. And if C doesn't trust A, also doesn't really help. But assuming we have both of those things, we're good. Yes? It's supposed to be A's private key like it is on these slides? Yes. I'm not sure why I posted the wrong slide back there. But, sorry, yes, that will be corrected after the lecture. Okay, so this is the idea that's used to make public keys work on the internet. And the way that looks is we have what are called certificate authorities. So those are our A's. They're the people who have lots of public keys they want to give out, but you don't talk to them directly. Instead, people have a pre-recorded message from them that's signed that says, foo.com's public key is this. And when you talk to foo.com, rather than talking to the certificate authority directly, you get that message forwarded to you. So you get a message saying, this certificate authority, which you for some reason should trust, says that foo.com's public key is this, and that's how you know foo.com's public key, assuming somehow your machine already knows the certificate authority's public key. So that's the model. And website certificates are just how HTTPS works. And we can look at a dump that is truncated and still very, very long and takes up multiple slides of a human-readable form of one of these certificates. So this is the certificate for a website you have probably used. And we can see that it has a few parts here. So we have a version number, we have a serial number, we have an indication that it's signed, because this is a signed message. So what's signed? Well, what's signed is going to be all this stuff here is going to be signed, including stuff that's on the next slide. It's going to be signed. And it's saying it's signed using this type of signature, and it has an issuer. So this is our identity of our certificate authority. This is who's sending us the message. And the message is about the public key for the subject, which in this case is the CoLab website. Now, of course, we need the actual public key. So that's in the next part of the certificate. You have the actual data for the public key included here. And you probably think, okay, then we just need a signature, which we have down here, and we're all set, right? Surely we don't need to put more stuff in here. And well, unfortunately, there's a lot of cruft, so we do. And there's two kind of important things here. So one, is that part of the information that's signed is what the certificate authority thinks that this public key should be used for. And they're saying, you can use this for web server authentication or web client authentication. And also, we have a list of other names for the subject of the certificate, who this is about, who has this public key. And this is actually the place the browser checks for the names. You would think, oh, they're going to check this. That's not what they check. This is what they check. And it says that these are the websites it's valid for. It's the public key for these websites. And we have a list of a bunch of different variants of the Colab website that all share the same public key. Yes?
Do the certificate authorities kind of act like a DNS server, and like the web browser is going to ask for the certificate and then they cache it?
So the question is, do the certificate authorities act like a DNS server? And the answer is no. So what we're going to do with the certificate is that if I'm operating colab.its.virginia.edu, I'm going to have a copy of the certificate, and I'm going to send it when web browsers connect to me. And that's going to be OK, even though the web browsers don't yet know who I am, because they're going to check the signature on it and know it came from the certificate authority, even though it wasn't sent directly from the certificate authority. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Question, do you need a certificate for every website you visit? So every website that uses HTTPS needs to have a certificate that somehow specifies its name here for it to work in your browser. Unless you've configured your browser in a weird way. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
If the authority doesn't send it to us directly, where do we get it from?
If the authority doesn't send it to us directly, where do we get it from? So when your web browser connects to a web server, part of the things the web server sends back is going to be this certificate. And I'll go through that in more detail later. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, how does this lower the work if we still have to get the public key? So in this scheme, I don't have to have gotten the public key in advance. And that's the key thing. So when I install a new OS on my machine, my new OS doesn't need to come with the public key of all the websites I'm going to visit. We can figure that out as we go. And also, if the website changes public keys, they just give us a new certificate. They don't have to update every client who's visited them in the past. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So how would we get the public key of the certificate authority?
Question, how would we get the public key of the certificate authority? So the typical solution for this is a bunch of them are shipped with your OS or browser. And hopefully you downloaded your OS or browser in a secure way somehow. And if you didn't, well, that's a big problem. Okay, so we have this certificate here. And the issuer part of it claims it's signed by this thing called the in-common RSA server CAs. CA for certificate authority. RSA is a type of public key signatures that the certificate uses, run by something called Internet2. What's going on there? So that's the certificate authority. So you might say, OK, so my browser must have a copy of the in-common RSA server CA's public key. And the answer is probably not. Instead, that certificate authority has their own certificate from another certificate authority, in particular from the user trust RSA certificate authority, and that's the one that probably comes with your OS or browser. And when you go to the Colab site, the Colab server sends both of these certificates, so your web browser can verify Colab certificates signed by this in-common one and the in-common one signed by something I actually know about, and therefore figure out, okay, this really is Colab, assuming I trust everyone involved in this whole chain. And this idea is called certificate chains. Now, a weird thing about this is if you know how these CAs actually work, they're both operated by a UK-based company which goes by the brand name Sekigo. The actual corporate name is Komodo. And you might be surprised by that because this is not the UK. And if you look at the issuer information for the User Trust RSA Certification Authority, it says it belongs to a New Jersey company called User Trust, which no longer exists. So that's just things which happen. So it turns out that we have our this RSA User Trust Security, User Trust RSA Certification Authority, which was originally operated by a company called User Trust. That was in 2004. Yes, that is how long this has been around. Acquired by Komodo. And Komodo was renamed their CA division to Zectigo in 2018. So now the names have nothing to do with who runs it or anything, but it's still in browsers and OSs, so they still use it. And they sort of have a certificate that points to this other certificate authority they operate called the In Common Server CA, which they also operate, but they're operating it on behalf of another organization. And the other organization in this case is Internet2, which is a nonprofit that has many universities as members. And that's why we get most of our certificates from them. And if you look at their website, they let universities pay a fixed fee and get as many certificates as they want all the time. And there are other sort of examples of certificate authorities in these chains. So as an example, if you, I looked up a certificate for google.com that my browser got, and it was signed by a certificate authority called the GTSCA1C3. That's the name that was in the certificate. And you go up the chain and it goes to this certificate authority called the GTS Root R1. And both of these are operated by a subsidiary of Google called Google Trust Services. And this was in turn signed by a company called GlobalSign, which was actually a division of a Japanese company called the GMO Internet Group these days. Yeah?
How do we decide where the chain originates? Just whoever we cross-post?
The question is, how do we decide where the chain originates? So some set of what we'll call trust anchors are shipped with browsers and OSs. So for example, most browsers and OSs have a copy of the User Trust public key and the GlobalSign Root CA public key. As most of them, but not as many, also have a copy of the GTS Root R1 one. So when trying to figure out is it trusted, they'll look for anyone they trust. So if they have this GTS Root R1 one, they presumably just won't check the certificate from GlobalSign because they don't need it. Yeah.
Great. And so for any certificate that's not immediately in that list, if they go up the chain and then find one of these, then they trust it, right?
So the question is, for any certificate that's not on the list, if they go up the chain and they find one of these, then they trust it? Yes. I should note as a caveat that the types of the certificates that we allow to do this chaining are not the ones we get from the normal certificates here. So I guess I didn't show it, but in the omitted information here, there's a CA false in the CoLab certificate saying it's not a certificate authority, it can't make certificates. Yes? Do certificate authority and certification authority mean different things? Probably. I only know the term certificate authority as a well-defined security term. Does that answer your question?
I'm just asking about its use here as user-trust RSA certification authority, and then also CA being used.
Oh, user-trust RSA certification authority. Okay. I believe I copied the name that was in the certificate field, which doesn't have to mean anything. So presumably it means the same thing, but I don't know what they were doing in the 90s. Yeah?
Do certificates ever expire?
Yes. The certificates for individual websites typically don't last more than a year these days. These root certificates kind of often have a planned lifetime of like 30-ish years, which sometimes gets accelerated because things change or and so on. But something around 30 years, yeah.
Yeah, also curious, is like this certificate chain, because it seems like if one part of the chain is taken over, then
the question is, how secure is this? We will explore that from multiple angles in a bit. So one angle, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if it's happened to, a bunch of, big ones yet, but, what happens when these, root ones kind of expire?
So question, what happens when these root ones kind of expire? So if you look at the set of trust anchors that is in your browser or OS, and I guess I have the next slide for that, there's a lot of them. And often, as you can see from the numbers here, one company or organization that operates certificate authorities will have multiple roots because they're going to transition from one to the other. So they'll typically get a new one included a couple years in advance of the expiration. So they can switch to that one after most of the browsers and websites have it. Yes?
So if Collabs expires tonight, does UVA, since we're planning on transitioning off of Collab, does that mean that they get a shorter certificate?
So the question is, the expiration time here of the one I got was tonight, so presumably they're changing it, probably some automated process. Do they get a shorter one because they're changing over? Probably not. 1 year is kind of the standard max duration you can get these days for a website certificate. Yes?
So the certificate you get for Collab, is that also going to include the certificates of everything else up the chain?
So the question is, the certificate we get for Collab also going to include the certificates of everything else we get up the chain? So when you download the certificate, they'll usually give you instructions on how to configure your web server to send the ones up the chain also. But they'll often be packaged separately. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have a bunch of trust anchors, and this sort of general idea is called a public key infrastructure. And we have one for websites that's probably the most prominent. These also exist for other things. So for example, there's actually a public key infrastructure of sorts for domain name system records, where we have some authorities, typically the people who operate the main domain name root servers, who can sign things so you can verify domain name records. We have one in OSs with app stores to verify those applications come from the right place, using the same kind of ideas, or for encrypted email in some cases, and a bunch of other context. Yes? The question is, when you verify this link here, does that tell you about how trustworthy the link is?
Right, so in the future, if you saw that certificate, could you just stop there instead of going up to user
trust? So your question is, can we cache that exists? Yes. So that's something that browsers might do just to speed things up a little bit. As for whether it's trustworthy, that's more of a value judgment. But the policy would be that it's trusted. Trusted is a common thing we do, which is not the same as trustworthy. Other questions? Yeah.
And also,
does that mean browsers with more trust anchors will go faster? It's probably not a significant difference because there's a big gap between what percentage of websites use the top five certificate authorities and all the rest. Also, some of these certificate authorities are included really for some of these other types of public key infrastructure, like for signing application code. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I told you that certificate authorities will give you a certificate for a website. So I have a question. How do you think that if I'm running a certificate authority and you come to me for a certificate for foo.com, I should verify that you actually should get one? Anyone? What should I do to do that? Yeah.
You should have some sort of proof of identity, an IP address, and check it against the
so you set your idea is I went to check like the IP address of the website, but I looked that up over DNS, so you better hope no one's attacking the network in a bad way. But yeah, that's a good idea. Any other things? Yeah. Okay, you can make them add things to their DNS records to prove that they control the DNS server in some way, and hopefully that's, you know, that at least tells you that they control the website. Do they control it legitimately? That's more complicated. Other ideas? I guess people don't know about who is anymore. So another obvious idea is that the domain registrars keep records of who owns domain names, and you can look up those records and get like a mailing address or a phone number and use that. Or, you know, they could ask them to communicate with you some way and so on. Or other ideas here. So I'm going to tell you what's actually done, which may or may not be what you want to be done. So what's actually done is, well, there's an organization called the CA Browser Forum that decides these rules for what publicly trusted CAs do. And it's an organization of pretty much everyone, not everyone, but pretty much everyone who ships code that has a list of certificate authorities in it and a bunch of certificate authorities. And they decide on rules called the baseline requirements for how CA should do this. And the main procedures that they do are the CA is supposed to choose a random value and either send it to the domain contact, so they look up with your registrar, where you registered foo.com with, your contact info and send you a random value and have you prove that you have that value, or they observe that random value being placed in a DNS record or on your website in some specific way. So any things that you think this might not really protect against? Any problems you see with this scheme? Yeah?
Yeah, I'm thinking they're sending a random value to the domain contact.
Question, they're sending a random value to the domain contact? Yeah, so for example, let's say foo.com is registered with, you know, bar@gmail.com. They'll email bar@gmail.com a random value and have you pasted it on a website where you requested the certificate. Maybe.
So
you would send 5 to bar@gmail.com and they would tell foo.com to put 5 on the website. They would probably tell you to send it back on like where you ordered the domain, where you ordered the certificate, I should say. Like, so you order a certificate, as part of the order process, they'll email you something to verify that you actually control that email address and have you sort of paste the value. And the value, hopefully, is much harder to guess than 5. Does that answer your question about sort of what this random value idea is? So any things that this doesn't really protect against? Yeah. So your concern is if the value gets corrupted, then this process would fail. That is a problem. But I'm talking about problems where maybe we could have the verified domain they shouldn't. Issue a certificate they're not supposed to. But I agree there's issues where this process could fail and they could not issue a certificate they are supposed to. Other, yes, yeah. So one concern is that if you lose control of your email, well, now we have a certificate for your website. And it's actually a little worse than that, because email isn't usually encrypted. There's no requirement to encrypt it here. So someone can just intercept your email, like from insecure Wi-Fi or something. Probably not insecure Wi-Fi the way where your email server is, but from an insecure network, and just intercept it passively, and now they can use that random value.
Sent with standard TLS. Do you just mean that email isn't required to do it, or that like
So your question is, you observe that Gmail often uses TLS for mail transport. Do I mean that email isn't required to do that, or just often doesn't? It isn't required to do that. And there's no requirement in the baseline requirements for CAs that they do that. Even if Gmail supports it, they can send unencrypted messages to Gmail. Yes? Does the certificate authority consider whether foo.com is malicious or not? They are allowed to do that. They don't have to. What if the domain registrar is compromised? Yeah, so if the domain registrar can be somehow fooled to giving the wrong contact information, oops. And this is something that has happened, that someone faxed something to a domain registrar to get them to update something they shouldn't have, took over a website. Okay, another thing I'd observe is that with putting something on the DNS for the website, well, if you can compromise, if you can take over the website in that way, then you'll get a certificate anyways, which is precisely what we were supposed to be protecting against. But that's what the rules are. That if you can prove practical control, you get the certificate. So there are some things public CAs do which are maybe a little less disappointing if you're worried about someone trying to take over your website and the certificate being a very significant extra layer of security. So one of them is that they have a database of revoked certificates. So browsers will sometimes check when they get a certificate, is this certificate still valid? And there's ways where the certificate authorities can publish that this certificate's no longer valid even though it hasn't expired yet. And that's one way we can deal with partially certificates, you know, authorities not being trustworthy at some point. And I wrote that they check these sometimes because the story about how often they check them is maybe not as nice as you'd like. And it's mainly because people don't like their websites not working when the checking fails because of a network problem. There's big effort called certificate transparency in that there's a publicly accessible log of every single issued website certificate. And browsers make sure that you don't accept certificates that aren't in this log. And this means that if you operate a website, like if you operate foo.com, you can know if anyone else gets a certificate for it reliably. So that's actually nice. Yeah. Question, what's an example of tamper-resistant hardware? Oh, so I have this first item here is that their private keys are in tamper-resistant hardware. So this is hardware which is somehow physically built, so the typical ways of extracting data from it that you're not supposed to extract are going to not work. And in the best versions of this, they might do something like have a sensor for like opening the wrong thing that will erase the private keys. Yes?
When you say that some browsers can reject non-log certificates, does that mean that I, as a user, when I try to click on a website, it's not going to open, or that website's never going to pop up in the first place?
The question, what I mean when they say browser rejects non-log certificates? That means when you go to a website which doesn't have a certificate that's logged appropriately, your browser will display an error similar to if it didn't have a valid certificate at all. Just say, you can't access this website. Yes?
Like, what would have to happen in order for a website to have a certificate that wasn't logged?
What would have to happen for a website to have a certificate that wasn't logged? This, under the current rules, the certificate authorities would have to make a mistake. Other questions? Yeah.
So why can I use my browser just to visit like HTTP websites like without the S if they don't have a certificate?
Question, why can you use your browser to visit HTTP websites without the S? Because not everyone wanted to use things that give you confidentiality and authenticity. And we still have to support that. Other questions? Comments? Okay, so talked about that. We'll skip that. Okay, so talked about certificates. I'm going to talk briefly about a few other cryptographic tools that we want you to know about, but I think aren't as directly useful as the encryption, signatures, message authentication codes we already talked about. So one thing that comes up is digital signature algorithms, and also public key encryption algorithms, but relevantly for this, digital signature algorithms, when you sign a message, they actually have usually have a limit on how big a thing the sign operation works on. So to deal with this, we want some way of summarizing a big message into something short we can pass to this sign function. And a common way you do that is a hash function, but we actually care a little more about the hash function than you do like for a hash table. So we'll use what's called a cryptographic hash function. And a cryptographic hash function, you know, is going to do the thing of, you know, it produces an essentially, you know, evenly distributed value from your message. But it needs to be stronger than a general hash function. One way it needs to be stronger is that I shouldn't be able to generate a message with a particular hash except by guessing, basically. And this is important if we use it for signatures. If I sign the hash of something instead of the original thing, it's really bad if someone can take the thing I signed and make another message with the same hash. We don't want that to be possible. So we're going to prevent that. And we also want it to be the case that I can't generate two different messages that hash to the same thing. If we think of the signature example again, I could sign one message, and when someone asked what I signed, I didn't actually sign the message, I signed the hash of it. I'll reveal a second message and say, no, that's the message. And that would be, you know, not give us what we expect from signatures, which is just that there's a single message that was signed, not multiple ones. So questions about cryptographic hashes? Yes?
Yeah.
Oh, question for this property, I wrote hash of second message equals h, I meant to write x. And you were asking, why was that h? Yes, so it's supposed to be x. It's hard to find two things. It's always hard to find a second message with the same hash, or even the first message with the hash if you don't know another one. So cryptographic hashes come up in all sorts of other uses where we want to basically summarize some data in some way where we know, you know, we can trust the summary is not like a summary of some different data sometimes. And if you think of hash tables, like in hash tables, we can have collisions. And in hash tables, collisions are just slow. But cryptographic hash functions, we want collisions to be basically impossible for an attacker to set up. Rather, because it's not just going to make things slow, it's going to make things insecure. So this will come up a bunch with dealing with message limits. Sometimes message authentication codes use these cryptographic hashes internally. And there's a third use that comes up a lot, which is password hashing. So often we want to check a password, but we don't want to actually store the original password. And this hash seems like a good way to do that, because if we think of our message as the password, given the hash of it, I can't get the password anymore. That's very good. And also, if I know the hash, I also can't get another password that has the same hash. So it seems great. And it's a good start, but there's an important property we want when we're hashing passwords that normal cryptographic hashing functions don't give us. And the problem is, well, with a normal cryptographic hash function, we can guess until we, have something which matches. And normally, that's not a problem, but with passwords, it kind of is. Because it turns out, good cryptographic hash functions, they try really hard to make them fast. And normally, that's a good thing. We want everything to be fast. But for guessing your password, we don't want it to be fast. So what people try to use instead is they use special cryptographic hash functions which are deliberately slow or resource intensive to limit how much guessing you can do in practical time. These are typically built from the fast cryptographic hash functions, but we have to slow them down so you can't like guess a billion, check a billion passwords and see if you can guess what, which one has the right hash. Yes?
When you say slow, is that like a millisecond versus a microsecond?
Chris, when we say slow, is that a millisecond versus a microsecond? It could be. These functions are configurable in how slow they are, which is kind of a deliberate choice, so you can make them as slow as you can stand, basically. Other questions? Okay, so another thing to bring up is I talked about symmetric encryption first, and then we talked about this asymmetric stuff, which I said is much more convenient. And you might say, why do we bother with this symmetric stuff if we have this asymmetric stuff that's a lot more flexible? And there's sort of two big practical reasons. So one reason is the symmetric stuff is much faster. It is that microsecond versus millisecond difference. It's hugely faster, and it's much better at supporting large messages. The asymmetric stuff has real message size limits that will get in your way. The symmetric stuff, you can send terabytes easily. So often we'll use asymmetric stuff to set up symmetric stuff. And this means that commonly what we're using asymmetric stuff for is not sort of our whole conversation, but setting up some symmetric keys. And this gives us a problem of what we'll call key agreement. And we can do this with public key encryption. So one idea for doing it with public key encryption is that if we have someone's public encryption key, we generate a secret key for symmetric encryption and encrypt it using public key encryption, send it to them, then do everything else with the fast symmetric encryption stuff. And that's a common model. So there's another model we're going to talk about, which is going to be based on a special public key tool that is designed specifically for generating keys for symmetric encryption. And I'm mentioning this mainly because it's actually used a lot. We're going to talk about how TLS works. This is part of TLS, this special tool. And in this tool, we have this special primitive where we generate some random values, and we derive something that's kind of like a public key, we'll call a key share from those values. And we have some math set up so that A can send, can generate their secret random value and send a key share based on that to B, and B can combine that with their secret random value to get a number, and A can combine their private data with B's public key share to get a number, and they'll both get the same number. And no one else will know what the number is, assuming they only have these key shares, because the key shares are that like public keys, they're not something that you can reverse. You can't go back to the secret data, and you need one, either A secret data or B secret data to get the number, but you don't need both of them. And this model is a common scheme called Diffie-Hellman key agreement. I'm not going to talk about the math that makes this work, but sort of the interface we provide is A chooses some random value and generates this public value, this key share derived from that, and sends it to B. B chooses a random value, generates their own key share, and these key shares we can kind of think of as public keys, and A combines their secret value with B's public value. And B combines the random value from they have with A's public value, and they both get the same number because of how the math is chosen to work, very carefully chosen. Okay, so questions on this scheme? So our usage for this is that rather than having public keys, we will both send these key shares to each other, and we'll do the combination, and we'll get this number. We'll use that number as our symmetric keys, as our encryption key and our message authentication key for the rest of talking to each other. Some questions? This overall key agreement scheme. Question, the number is used for symmetric encryption? Yes, so it's used to derive keys for symmetric encryption and message authentication codes. Or potentially anything else you want, but that's the most common use. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. We'll skip over that. So let's talk about how TLS works. So TLS is a protocol which has a lot of modes, and TLS is the protocol that makes HTTPS work. It's the security part of that. So I'm going to show you what TLS looks like. And I'm sort of showing the high-level messages that are sent in the most common version of setting up TLS, because it has a lot of modes. And we have our client, this is like our web browser, and our server. And our client first sends these two messages called client hello, which is the begin conversation message, and a key share, which is that public part of that key agreement. So it sends this public part of the key, this key exchange, so we can later get some shared symmetric keys. And the server is going to send back its own key share. So now both the client and server can generate some shared keys. But we're not done yet, because we need to know like what web server we're talking to. We had that whole certificate thing earlier. So what the server will do is it will send their certificate and any certificates needed to interpret that certificate, so the whole chain of certificates. And it will send this certificate verify message, which is the signature proving that the server's key share actually came from the server. It's a signature with a private key corresponding to the certificate and that key share. So the client can know that this key share I just got, it came from the right website. It didn't come from some other website. Then the server will send a message verifying that all the stuff it sent is from the right conversation, that there was no replay attacks, that someone didn't like copy and paste a message from a different TLS session. And the way they do that is we derive a message authentication code key from our shared number, and we send the MAC tag of the hash of everything we've done so far. And then the client also sends that back with the hash of everything so far, including the previous finish message. Yes?
For the key exchange part, couldn't a listener on the network interfere both sides of the message and then kind of set their own version of the message so they kind of get the AMP?
So the question is, why can't some malicious party interfere here and substitute their own key share messages in both directions? And they can. The problem we'll get to is they can't make a valid certificate verify message. Because when they want to make a certificate verify message, they change the key share there, so they're not going to have a signature of the right thing. And that, for that reason, the web browser will reject it and discontinue the connection. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, why doesn't the attacker have foo.com's private key, or can't they change the foo.com's private key? So the client is going to know foo.com's private key because there's a certificate for it. The attacker's not going to be able to make a certificate, hopefully, that says foo.com's private key is something else. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so this process I showed here is called the handshake, because we're setting up the connection. And this is the entire part of TLS that uses asymmetric encryption stuff. So it uses signatures, and it uses that key share idea, which is kind of asymmetric cryptography, I should say. Something with public key-like stuff. After that, the client and server take the key shares results, so that common shared number, and they derive a whole bunch of keys from it. And in particular, they have different encryption keys for each direction and different authentication keys for each direction, and they just use them for the rest of the conversation. And they use nonces, that is like numbers used once, to make sure that an attacker like can't reorder, like can't copy and paste different parts of the conversation. They have to stay in the same order. So that's my super brief summary of how TLS works in the most common setup. Questions about that? Yes?
Didn't you also make an argument that TLS is an example of symmetric encryption?
Can I make the argument that TLS is an example of symmetric encryption because there are shared values? I would say TLS uses symmetric encryption. It's not itself symmetric encryption, but it's a thing that uses symmetric encryption as a key tool. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Where does this process happen? Like, for example, when I send a request to a web server or ask for a HTML page, does it happen like before the server sends back the requested page?
So the question is, where in this process, if I'm talking to a web server, does the web page get sent back? And that's all going to be happening after we do this entire exchange. Other questions? Okay. So TLS, like this overall protocol, what does it give us? Well, it gives us confidentiality and authenticity. Now, authenticity is kind of weird to describe with the client because we don't actually verify who the client is. But what we do verify is that it's the same client through the whole connection. That you don't have someone in the middle like taking what our client sends and then adding some extra stuff at the end. They can't do that. We also get forward secrecy. So the reason why TLS uses this key share idea is that the data, the private data for the key shares is temporary. So if I compromise a web server today, I'm not going to be able to decrypt stuff that's a month old because the private numbers for those key shares have been deleted. They no longer exist, so I can't decrypt old stuff that way, which didn't used to be the case in older versions of TLS, which was considered not so great. And the other thing is that it's pretty fast because most of the communication is done with symmetric ciphers. That if we're sending lots of data, it's very fast because we're using those fast math, not the slow math. And also, in terms of how many trips we have back and forth, the modern version of TLS has sort of one round trip to set things up, which is basically as good as we can do. Questions? It's on TLS. Okay. So that sort of concludes where I'm going to talk about cryptography stuff. But I have a few small miscellaneous security topics I should mention. And most of these come up from things that we kind of ignored when we talked about cryptography. So cryptography, we said, we're going to assume the network is arbitrarily mean, and you know that's going to try to manipulate us. And we're going to have cases where you know the network, if they want to stop things from working, they can do that. But let's say our attacker just wants to break things. And if they control the network, there's nothing we can do. If they control the network, they can just make the network not work. So I haven't been worried about that when I talked about this cryptography stuff, but in the real world, we have attackers who don't have that sort of control over the network. They can't intercept all our messages individually, but they can still break things. And this kind of problem is known as denial of service. So as an example, you know, if they just want to inconvenience us, they can just send a lot of stuff to our server. Our server might not be able to handle that. Our network might not be able to handle that. And that requires a lot less access than like intercepting individual messages, right? It's really simple to do. But you might say, maybe we shouldn't be concerned about this because, you know, yes, the attacker can do this, but it sounds like this is a lot of work for the attacker, right? That the attacker is putting in basically as much effort to do this attack as we are to handle their tons of messages. But there's a problem with this in practice, in that it's pretty easy. Oh, I have this the wrong way around. For the work for the defender to be much more than the work for the attacker in this case. And this is actually kind of intuitive if you think about what you can do as an attacker. So let's say I'm sending messages to my web server, to a web server to overload it. I can probably make the web server do a lot of work. Let's say there's a search form. Instead of just requesting web pages, I'm going to request the most complex search I can. That's pretty easy for me to send, probably a lot of work on the web server. Or, you know, maybe, you know, I'm going to request a file that's gigabytes and just not have it go to my network when it comes back. There's things the attacker can do in practice that make this very asymmetric. Also, the attacker might have an easier time having more resources. And one example of why is that the attacker needs to have like 100 machines for an hour to inconvenience you. To defend against this, you need to have 100 machines all the time. You know, that's kind of an inherent asymmetry there. And there's another thing which commonly comes up when this happens in the real world, which is kind of reflection or amplification attacks. So instead, if I want to attack a server and just overload it, one thing I could do is I could send it a bunch of requests myself. But another thing I can try to do is I can try to have someone else send it requests for me. So an example where this happens has been with DNS. So the way DNS traditionally works, that you can send DNS over UDP, and that DNS request says, hey, I'm coming from this IP address and this port number, and I would like to know the records for this name. And if your ISP is not checking things carefully, you could send those requests with an IP address that you don't actually control. You can say, hey, I'm this web server I'm attacking. Please send me this really big DNS record. You can send a bunch of those messages, and this DNS server unwittingly will send these huge amounts of data to that web server you're attacking. This is commonly known as amplification attacks, when people are talking about denial of service attacks, where this unwitting third party is fooled into turning what would be a small attack into a really big one. So, this is an example of sort of one of the reasons why, besides that sort of inherent asymmetry of resources, it's pretty hard to deal with large denial of service in practice, because there are these kind of sneaky ways of making your attack really big without much resources. Some questions on sort of our general notion of denial of service attacks sort of having this asymmetry, which is why they're often a problem in practice. Okay. So the last thing we'll talk about in just 3 minutes. There's another topic we should mention briefly to make sure you're exposed to it, is firewalls. And this is just about the idea that, well, if I'm concerned about malicious traffic on my network, things coming in like just trying to overload my servers, I want a way to filter out some traffic. And tools for doing this are known as firewalls. And these are filters that are going to be either in our OS or on routers in the middle of the network that are somehow going to filter out some traffic for us so we can limit what's allowed. And typically, the way these firewalls work, they'll have a set of rules. And they might be very simple rules like I have here, where they'll say, oh, if you get a message that's part of TCP for website ports, allow that from everyone. If you get SSH, allow that from my desktop, not from anyone else. You know, and we can specify more specific rules to filter out the traffic. And you know, this would be probably one of the things we would try to do if we had a denial of service attack, is we try to limit, you know, what messages we accepted. And possibly try to do that not just on the machine that's accepting the messages, but earlier in the network. Yes?
But if the attacker is trying to access the server, like disguised as my IP address, wouldn't it still work?
So question, if I had this rule that tries to make it so only I can SSH into my server, but the attacker, you know, puts my IP address in those packets, wouldn't the attacker still be able to access it? Yes. So our hope is that someone between us and the attacker has a rule preventing them from doing that, but if not, we're out of luck. Other questions? Comments? Okay. So these sorts of filters, and I've shown sort of the very simple version. We could imagine filters that like check like the contents of the messages and other things like that, and that's a thing that exists in practice. So that's where I'm going to finish up talking about network security. So just to summarize sort of what we talked about. We talked about, okay, we have untrusted networks. How do we make them trustworthy using math? And we have these key tools of encryption and authentication. We started out with these ones based on shared secrets. And then we moved on to these things based on public keys, where we could broadcast a key to everyone. And we had the secret part only for ourselves, the private key. We mentioned that just these primitives aren't good enough by themselves. We had like replaying messages causing problems. And then we talked about sort of how we constructed the most commonly used scheme out there, what we use for websites. And we had this idea of certificates, a way of forwarding public keys, which we needed because you can't get the keys for all the websites in advance. So we need it forwarded to you somehow. And a way to do key agreement, so sort of a public key scheme for quickly setting up symmetric encryption. So that with TLS. So that's where I'll finish up today, since I'm out of time. And next time we'll move on to hashes.